Well, it's a great joy for me to be back here at First Baptist Edmonton today. As Keith mentioned at the beginning of the service, my wife and I had been working as CBM missionaries in France for 19 years, and we were on home assignment in 1998, and we were missionaries in residence here at First and several of the Edmonton Baptist churches. My wife is originally from Edmonton. Her home church is Braemar, and she's actually preaching there next Sunday. Several months ago, Chris was down in Toronto and asked if I was out in Edmonton, if I would come and be with you here at First, and it really is a joy for me. I have to share, the last time I preached in this church, and it would have been in 1998, I was sitting over there, and Gary Nelson had introduced me, and I preached, and at the beginning of my sermon, I shared a story about Nepal and about the incredible growth of the church in Nepal, and this had never happened to me after I preached. I went and I sat back down, and Gary leaned over, and he pointed to a person, I want to say in the choir, but it might have been in one of the pews, and he said, that woman there was a missionary in Nepal for many, many years. I don't remember how many years. And afterwards, she came up to me and corrected a few of the historical facts that I had shared in my sermon. So before I begin my sermon, I just need to know if anybody here was ever a missionary in India. Because if you were a missionary in India, I'm going to have to change a few of my lines as I get going here. Good. So far, so good. I can carry on. Before I begin, I'm obliged, and I'll be asked on Tuesday when I get back to the office if I've done this. I am obliged to share with you, and I actually do it with great joy, sharing with you the warm greetings of Brian and Charlene Craig, as well as Carla and Gary Nelson. This church has made an incredible investment in the life of our Baptist mission globally by these two families. Brian and Charlene are living in Cambridge now. Charlene Craig, who was a member here for many years, is our Director of Human Resources and Member Care at CBM, and she's brought an incredible skill and talent and professionalism to the way human resources are handled in our organization, and she's actually been called upon to share her knowledge and experience with other mission agencies, and it's a real joy for me to work side by side with Charlene. At the same time, Gary Nelson, who was your minister here at First for many years, is our venerable leader and a great friend for me, and I enjoy working with Gary. We carpool to work every day that the two of us happen to be in Canada, or at least in Toronto, and because we live very close one to another, and as I do with Gord King as well, the director of the Sharing Way, so we begin our work early in the morning when we drive in together. I really enjoy working with Gary. Gary is actually flying home as we speak this morning. He's flying home from Ghana, Accra, Ghana, where he was representing CBM and all of our Baptist churches in Canada at the annual assembly of the Baptist World Alliance. Gary, as you know, is also one of the vice presidents of the Baptist World Alliance, and so he is there. But I do know that they will ask if I share their greetings and salutations with you. We've gone through an exciting time at CBM in the last few years. It's been a time of growth, of change, a refocusing in the way that we engage in global mission, trying to sharpen our own focus. Instead of trying to do many and many more things, we're actually saying let's do fewer things better. And so we've limited the number of countries that we're working in. We've limited the scope of some of the work that we're doing in order to bring things back into focus, and it's had a real impact. We've been excited to see the response of churches in Canada to the way this change has come about. One of the examples of that is how your own church, First Baptist Edmonton, is part of a partnership with CBM in Bolivia through the STEP program. STEP is a very intentional program whereby local churches in Canada work alongside CBM in impacting integral or holistic mission in a specific country through our partner network. And so First Baptist and CBM are working with the Bolivian Baptist Union, and it's a very exciting time, and I would encourage you or whoever in the church is representing the church and the missions committee to take this partnership very seriously. I'm excited about it, and I think that we have a great opportunity there. And I hope that we'll have a chance to maybe travel to Bolivia with several of the members of the church here and experience that partnership firsthand. But I thank you also on behalf of your brothers and sisters in Bolivia for your own generosity. Through the sharing way, you're making a real difference, and it's exciting. It's exciting to see it. So since none of you were ever missionaries in India, let me begin with a story from India, because I actually just recently returned from India. Gord King, the director of the Sharing Way, and I were in India about 4 months ago. And while we were there, we had an opportunity to see the exciting work of our Baptist heritage in India, an incredible ministry. For over 140 years, Canadian Baptists helped shape the spiritual and social life of two provinces in East India. What an amazing and complex context for global mission. Over the years, our work encompassed many different facets of Christian mission, from compassion to the poor and the oppressed, who were known as the untouchables back then, now we refer to them as the Dalits, to women's education, theological training, healthcare, primary school education, Bible translation, evangelism, advocacy, and community development. One of the programs that Gordon and I went and witnessed is a school in the small town called Tuni, which is right on the Indian Ocean. Tuni is a school named the Eva Rose York Girls Training School. In this small town of Tuni, young women, teenage girls, are given a second, and actually for many of them, a final chance. Most of them are from the lowest caste in Indian society. They either failed school or dropped out of school at a very early age, sometimes as young as 7 or 8 years old. And this school opens its door to give them another opportunity. Most of these girls would have otherwise entered the labor force as young as 10 or 11, maybe 12 years old. The Eva Rose York School gives them another chance. It's a very basic education they receive at Eva Rose York. It's reading and writing, the morning some Bible classes. In the afternoon, they get what they call technical skills training. And when I say technical, it's not what we would refer to nowadays. These girls are learning how to sew on ancient Singer sewing machines with pedals. They're learning how to type on big, clonking, old manual typewriters with carbon paper. And they're learning that's the way they're doing things. These girls, these women, are part of a very tragic social fabric in India that persists even today, where most women aren't given a chance. Violence against women in India is rampant. They are denied very often the most basic human rights. In India, there are still tribes that practice feticide, which is basically the killing of infant babies of a certain gender. And so in this case, girls are killed at birth. Dowry deaths are common still in India. They say that in India, every 77 minutes, a young woman commits suicide because she cannot face the pressure for her family to pay the dowry at the point of marriage to her fiancé's family. In spite of incredible efforts on the part of the government and social workers, women are still disadvantaged in terms of survival, education, employment, and equality. I think it was because of the things that I witnessed while I was in India that this passage that Stan read for us in Mark chapter 5 is so important to me. I have a fond affection for it. It's one of those gripping narratives in Jesus' ministry in the Synoptic Gospels. It's a classic story, and Mark is great at this, showing Jesus in a crowd and then focusing in on the social interaction or intercourse between Jesus and one or two people in that crowd. And that's exactly what takes place here. It's a story of Jesus' interaction with a powerful person and with a powerless person. It's a story of Jesus' popularity, of his presence in a crushing crowd, of the people pressing in to get a glimpse of him, a touch of him, a glance, like a modern-day celebrity nowadays, maybe a rock star who comes to city, how that person passes through town, and it creates such a stir. Here we are in Mark chapter 5. Jesus is crowded in yet again by all kinds of people, when suddenly a man named Jairus rushes up to Jesus. He comes to him and he falls at Jesus' feet. Jairus is a wealthy, successful, prominent, and powerful leader. The passage tells us that Jairus was the ruler of the synagogue in the town, and hence he was the leading figure in the social fabric of that community. He was, as we would say, the big cheese. And Jairus comes to Jesus, and in a stunning act of humility, He cries out to Jesus for help. He falls at Jesus' feet, and he pleads with Jesus to come and to heal his sick 12-year-old daughter. "My daughter is at death's door," he says to Jesus. "Please come and touch her. Touch her and make her well." Here is a man at the very pinnacle of the socioeconomic scale. He was wealthy and powerful, and he was a man who had access to Jesus. He was probably accustomed to other people begging him for favors. But as I said, in this incredible act of humility, Jairus falls at Jesus' feet. You would have thought that he would send an emissary. He would have sent one of his staff to ask Jesus to come and to do a favor for him. But no, Jairus broke through a cultural custom. He broke through one of the social mores of the time. And he, the wealthy, influential man, comes to Jesus, and he falls down and he begs Jesus to help. In this incredible cry of desperation, he shows that not only does he have esteem for Jesus' healing power, but he shows he really, really loves his daughter, and he wants her to be well. At the time of Jesus, approximately 60% of all of the population never reached the age of 15 years. Death, infant or adolescent death, was not an uncommon thing. It happened. Sick children were not an unusual part of human life. But to Jairus, who was maybe used to getting his own way, it was clearly different. He was on the receiving end of a favor. He, or more like his 12-year-old daughter, really needed Jesus. Jesus' reputation had obviously preceded him, had made it around the lake faster than Jesus' boat could cross it. It's on the basis of this reputation that Jairus came to Jesus. He had heard what Jesus had done across the sea. And so he wanted to see Jesus. He wanted to have access to Jesus to beg him to heal his daughter. It was on the basis of that reputation that other people pressed in towards Jesus. They too wanted to catch a glimpse of him. They wanted to see the healer. Maybe a word from him. Perhaps just a touch. And in this crowd of people who were gathering around Jesus were many people who needed Jesus' help. So Jesus hears Jairus' plea, and off he goes. He heads off to Jairus' house when suddenly he feels a jolt. Something happened. Perhaps it was like a surge of energy. Someone had touched him. The passage says that Jesus felt that his power had come out of him, had gone out of him. Maybe he realized at that moment in a blind spot that his power had healed someone. And he looks around and he says, "Where is this person who touched me? Who touched my robe?" Throughout the Gospels, especially for Mark again, the disciples come across as a cynical, comical troupe who say dumb things. And Jesus is often looking at them, maybe rolling his eyes and chastising them for the things that they say that seem a little ridiculous. But this time, it's the disciples that make it look like Jesus is the one who has said something dumb. "How do you expect us to know who touched your robe? Everybody's trying to touch your robe. How would we ever know who touched your robe? How would we be able to identify the person that touched you so that your power went out of you?" the disciples asked. And at that moment, a woman steps forward to Jesus. She knows that it is she who has caused this kerfuffle. She falls at Jesus' feet, and she begs his mercy. "It was me." And she goes on to tell Jesus her story. Maybe I need to add here again that social mores are broken on the other side of the scale. Once again, you see, at this point in history, women didn't speak to men in public, let alone unclean women. But this woman bites the bullet. She steps forward. She admits that in her desperation, she was the one who reached out and touched Jesus' robe. She needed healing from a disease that had led her to be considered unclean for 12 long years. The disease is described as a hemorrhaging. Perhaps it was an uncontrollable menstrual flow that just wouldn't stop. It had inflicted her. All of her resources had been spent in consultation with numerous doctors trying to find a cure. All it had done is simply impoverished her, not only physically, but financially as well. Most likely, if she was spending her own money, as the passage says, she would have been a widow. She carried this stigma, this contagion of unholiness. But she was so desperate that she was willing to violate social mores and social boundaries in order to be healed. So she fights her way through a crowd, probably inevitably brushing up against many people, but because she had a disease, in doing so, she would have been contaminating them. She reaches out, and even though she was an unclean woman, she touches a man. Again, a social mores broken. And then when Jesus asked, "Who is it that touched me?" she speaks up, something that wasn't done at that time. She was breaking all kinds of boundaries. She touches a man in public. And that was highly improper at that point. So Jesus asks, "Who is it that touched me?" And the woman fesses up. I wonder why Jesus needed to know who it was that touched him. I asked myself, like, what difference does it make? Was it perhaps out of a sense of righteous indignation? How dare you? As if a woman who would be touched it inappropriately on a crowded bus or subway. How dare you? Or was it because of this woman's lack of social etiquette? Well, next time you could ask. Or was it because of this loss of voltage, this sense of the power surge I described? Power has gone out of Jesus. My power level has dropped. How did it happen? I don't think it was any of those. I think Jesus wanted to know because he needs to address a bigger issue than the healing of this woman. That being, what is the cause of the miraculous deed? At the time of Jesus, streets and paths were filled with many faith healers, perhaps charlatans, magicians, wonder workers. Crowds would gather. People would seek this surge of exhilaration. They would want a glimpse or a touch, perhaps. Everybody wanted to see what was going on. Jesus, I believe, needed to clarify the nature of the miracle and perhaps, more certainly, to perform a greater deed than even the healing of this woman. That's why he needed to know. That's why he asks, who is it that touches her? So this nameless woman, marginal and poor, speaks up. I did it. And she goes on, the passage says, to tell the whole truth. She tells everything about her exclusion, about her condition, about her brokenness, about everything about her. She was a castaway in society. Anthropologists tend to distinguish between a disease and an illness. A disease is a biological or a biomedical malfunction which affects an organism in the human body. That's a disease. An illness, according to anthropologists, is a disvalued state when social networks are interrupted and when meaning is lost. Illness isn't just physical, it's also social. It's what happens when a condition causes a breakdown in cultural norms and values. Illness is the stigma that people carry quite often because of a disease that they have. I can think of a few examples. I'm sure you can as well. At the time of Jesus, and even until very recently, leprosy was both a disease and an illness. There was the physical infirmity, but there was also a social stigma which was associated with it. In ancient Palestine, a leper was considered unclean, unfit for social intercourse, excluded from the community. This woman is described as carrying both a physical disorder but a social illness. In modern times and in different cultures, various factors lead us to focus on the exclusion of certain people. Perhaps they don't measure up to our standards, and so we refer to their condition as an illness. And it's a tragedy in our society that we still refer to people who have limited means, intellectual means, as being mentally ill. There's the sense of a social impact that goes along with their condition. Until very recently, and even unfortunately, even today, in many places in Western society, people who have HIV/AIDS are considered as carrying this stigma, an illness that goes along with it. Some of you may remember the SARS outbreak in Canada a few years ago. Suddenly, countless thousands of people were stigmatized, even though they didn't even have the disease. They were perceived as having been ill and therefore excluded. In this passage in the book of Mark, Jesus addresses a disease and an illness. He wants to know who touched him so that having healed the disease or the malady that the woman had, he could begin by healing the illness of this woman, that illness being rejection, exclusion. Here, a poor woman, probably a widow, definitely nameless and rejected without any resources, Jesus comes alongside her, cares for her, speaks to her. Jesus affirms her. He says this to her. He says, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." You understand the parallel of the disease and the illness in Jesus' words. Eugene Peterson translates it in the Message with these words. They're lovely. "Daughter, you took the risk of faith, and now you're healed and made whole. Live well. Live blessed. Be healed of your plague." She was delivered from her affliction, affirmed in her identity because Jesus gives her a name, a title. He calls her daughter. He gives her immediate status in the eyes of the crowd because he speaks to her, and he includes her in the community. In doing so, Jesus is demonstrating that the contagion of holiness that he bears is much more powerful than the contagion of unholiness that she bore, or that anyone, especially a poor, nameless, excluded widow, might bear. Jesus' miracle here is not just healing the disease, but healing the illness as well. Meanwhile, where is Jairus in this whole deal? I can just picture him standing over on the side, fuming. Here, the man who was at the top of the social ladder in his town had to humble himself and beg Jesus to come and to heal his poor 12-year-old daughter, sick 12-year-old daughter, dying daughter. He humbled himself publicly, in a sense of disgrace, but begged Jesus to come. And then now, he stands over on the sides. He was willing to accept to degrade himself in order to see his daughter healed. And he had to wait for some social misfit who was hogging all of Jesus' time. Time was of the essence for Jairus. But Jesus allowed himself to be distracted by this poor widow, this filthy widow, while his sick, innocent daughter was at death's door. And then it seems like it's too late. Messengers come and say to Jairus, "Don't bother interrupting Jesus. It's too late. We've lost her. Your daughter has passed away. Don't bother getting Jesus to come to your house. She's dead." Jesus overhears the messengers, and he overrides their message of doom. "Don't pay attention to them. Don't be afraid, Jairus. Just believe." Either very simple or very naive words. But perhaps with a nod of his head to the woman he has just healed, he says, "Have faith like hers." And the finale of this story is that there's this incredible shift from one daughter to the other. From one daughter who was dying for 12 long years to another daughter who had lived only 12 short years. And Jesus loves them both and cares for them both. He comes alongside them both. And Jesus, with a small contingent of his followers, enters the girl's room, touches the girl again, sense of touch, and makes her well. She too is restored to good health. She's restored to family. She's restored to community. And so Jesus says, "Let's celebrate. Let's have a meal together. Food and drink shared together to honor a life that was saved." Let me bring this together now in our own journey. Just think of this contrast that we've described, of a powerful man and a powerless woman, of a man with access and a woman of limitations, of a leader and a castaway, a man with a name and a woman without a name, a strong, caring community and a case of absolute exclusion. But in both cases, Jesus acknowledges that their faith in his transformational power, transforming power, is sufficient to restore health and wellness to both the girl and the woman, to cure a disease and heal an illness. This trip to India taught me an awful lot about the risks that the church needs to take in order to come alongside women and to help them when they need to find an inner healing, when they have been oppressed, when they have been broken, when they have been marginalized. I think it's great that our churches in Canada are part of a long line in a Christian tradition that did not despise, but rather sought equality and affirmed the dignity of women, even though in India and in many other places, they had been marginalized. In fact, an entire movement of women in India were raised up because of the work of Baptist missionaries. They were called the Bible Women, the turn of last century. These young women who were trained, who had come from the lowest caste, they were trained in scripture, they learned skills, and then they went in and they became the servants of the Brahmins. And in doing so, as the house servants of, in the Brahmin caste, the most elite caste in Indian society, they were able to bring the gospel and share the good news of Jesus Christ with the children of the Brahmins. And many people became followers of Jesus. Here were women who were acknowledged, affirmed, trained, empowered, and mobilized. This story is really a story about God's power and his transforming lives and his touch. And I ask us as a church today, what is our role as a Christian community? Are we willing to take the risk in order to seek restoration of people in our society who we might otherwise consider untouchable, undesirable, excluded? What will we do as a church for the poor, for the handicapped, for women? What are the risks that we're willing to take? Maybe we need to be a little bit more like Jairus, willing to humble ourselves in order to see Jesus act on behalf of someone we love, and then be willing, like Jairus, to accept the fact that we might have to wait. But maybe we need to be a lot more like that nameless woman who broke through the cultural mores and rules and barriers of her time and acted out of faith in Jesus' transforming power.